You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
So, Exodus. We'll say this is about when God calls, as we're going to read about the calling of Moses tonight. Now, it's been a couple weeks, plus some of you probably weren't there. So far in this book, in the first chapter and a half, we see that after 400 years of quiet, where we don't know of anything that any prophecy, no, absolutely no notion of what God's doing, all of a sudden the stopwatch clicks and God is back at work again. His people are in this area called Goshen, which is in the Nile Delta, one of the most fertile spots on earth, literally. Every spring, the Nile overflows its bank and covers the fields in silt that's rich for agriculture. And they had been given this area to live in by the Egyptians, and they multiplied from a family into a nation over the course of 400 years. So much so that the Egyptians began to worry that they were becoming too big, too powerful. They began to persecute them. They put them under slavery. And so, with this oppression and also murder, they were murdering baby males to try to keep the population down. God chose a kid, a deliverer, Moses. He would be the instrument that God would use to deliver and rescue his people out of slavery in Egypt. A baby's mother and sister were cooperating with God. It was not what my Sunday school taught, where she just put the baby in this basket and pushed it out on the Nile River and just hope something good happens. You know, it's like, that's child abuse. That's not what happened. They scoped out where the Pharaoh's daughter was bathing, snuck up and put it in the reeds right next to where they knew that she would find it. She comes down with her maids and servants to have a bath, and they see the basket over in the reeds, and she sends them over to get it. They open up the lid. Cute little baby. Yes, dark-skinned. Maybe not African-looking, more Arab-looking, but definitely not white. It's a baby of color. And all these people were. There were no white people in any of the story. Well, her heart was moved. She wanted to save the baby. She realized it was a Hebrew baby that was being thrown into the river, that were being killed. And so they worked out a deal where his mom continued to be a wet nurse. And then Pharaoh's daughter adopted Moses and raised him as her own son in the Pharaoh's palace. So God now has his man right inside, on the inside of the halls of power, Pharaoh's palace. Nobody knows he's a Hebrew. They wouldn't tolerate that if they knew it, because the Hebrews were slaves. He might know. His mom knew. We don't know when he found out. They think he's royalty. They think he's the grandson of Pharaoh. And so this is a good platform from which to launch a program of liberation. If he plays his cards right, maybe he'll even become Pharaoh himself, and then he can proclaim anything he wants. No, none of that's true. God had a completely different plan. And it starts, before we start, yes, this overarching theme that we see in Exodus, the polytheism of the Egyptians, and based on nature and natural forces, the river, the storm, and so forth. And then all of a sudden we come along with this other God, Yahweh. And that's a big theme in this book. Who is Yahweh? He's going to reveal himself like never before, like nothing that happened in the book of Genesis. This is the first time that God's really shown himself to humanity. Nobody knows who Yahweh is. Pharaoh doesn't know. He says, who is Yahweh that I would obey his voice and let Israel go? I don't know Yahweh, and I'm not going to let Israel go. Well, the Hebrews, they don't know him either. God says, after this, I'm going to take you for my people, and you will know that I'm Yahweh, your God, who brought you out from the burdens of the Egyptians. Later, they don't finally realize it. They don't realize it at this point. They weren't really following Yahweh very well. Moses doesn't know. He has to ask God, who are you anyway? And so they're like a lot of people probably in our world today. People who know that there is a God, who feel like, oh, there's something greater, there's some sort of a greater power. I really don't know, but I feel like there's something out there. And so maybe God exists, but what is he like? Who is he? That should be pretty applicable for us, this book. We're going to get an answer to that question. All right, we left off in chapter 2, verse 9, so I'll take up on 10. Later, when the boy was older, his mother brought him back to Pharaoh's daughter, who adopted him as her own son. The princess named him Moses, for she exclaimed, I lifted him out of the water. It's from a word meaning to pull out. Many years later, when Moses had grown up, he went down to visit his own people. Yeah, many. 40 years, as it turns out. From the birth of the baby until this next scene. He's 40 years old already. And he went down to see what was going on with the Hebrews, and he saw how hard they were forced to work. During his visit, he saw an Egyptian beating one of his fellow Hebrews. After looking in all directions to make sure nobody was watching, Moses killed the Egyptian. Took him out. And then he buried him in the sand and got out of there. Nice. So Moses decides, I'm going to help my people. Here, let's kill this guy. That'll teach him. Completely absurd. It's a foolish action. It's an immoral action. You can tell he knows he's in the wrong the way he's looking both ways before he springs at him. It's impulsive. He didn't think about it. And it's totally ineffective. It's not going to change anything. In fact, it's also probably self-serving. He probably killed the guy in rage and then realized I'm going to get caught. So then he buried him and tried to cover his tracks. Or he wounded him and then had to finish him off to keep it from getting back that he was fighting with the Hebrews. Well, the next day when Moses went out to visit his people again, he saw two Hebrew men fighting. Why are you beating up your friend? Moses said to the one who started the fight. And the man replied, who appointed you to be our prince and judge? Are you going to kill me like you did the Egyptian yesterday? Uh-oh, they know. And Moses was afraid, thinking, oh, now everyone knows what I did. Sure enough, Pharaoh heard what had happened, and he tried to kill Moses. The order went out, an arrest warrant. Get him. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in the land of Midian. He's going north into the Sinai Desert and over to a place called Midian. If you look up Midian in Wikipedia or wherever, they show an area to the east of the Gulf of Aqaba. More likely is what Bromley and other scholars are urged, which is that it's not a geographical area, but a league of tribes. On the map, you can see Midian is over here, and yet Moses, next time he shows up, is over here, across the Gulf of Aqaba. We also saw them earlier up in Israel, the caravan that they sold Joseph to? Midianites. Yeah. Midian is a son of Esau. And one of the other tribes, the Kenites, that are sometimes called Midianites too, was a son of Abraham through his second wife. So these were Abrahamic peoples. They probably spoke a dialect of Hebrew. We know that that Abraham and Esau spoke Hebrew. So now we're down many generations, but still, maybe this is where Moses learned to speak Hebrew. Or did he learn it in the Egyptian court? That's not unlikely either. We do find him talking with the Hebrews, probably in Hebrew. They wouldn't have been speaking Egyptian, probably. So they're wandering all over this area. They're nomadic. You have to keep moving because there's not enough fodder. And this desert is too dry to support standing still. You got to pull up and keep finding new areas that your livestock can graze on. He winds up there in Midian, sat down beside a well. Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters who came as usual to draw water and fill water troughs for her father's flock. But some other shepherds came and chased them away. So Moses jumped up, rescued the girls from the shepherds, and then he drew water for their flocks. A fight? Maybe. Moses must have been cut. How did he chase off this group of shepherds? He intimidated them somehow, and then he fetches water for the ladies while they wait their turn. And so when the girls return to Reuel, who's also later Reuel, the father, he asked, "Why are you back so soon today?" to his daughters. They said, "Well, this Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds. And then he drew water for us, and he watered our flocks." "Well, where is he?" her father asked. "What, did you leave him out there? Invite him to come up and eat with us." A very homey, detailed story. You can tell this is a personal memoir. The guy that wrote this was there. Moses accepted the invitation, and he settled there with him. In time, Reuel gave Moses his daughter Zipporah to be his wife. Later, she gave birth to a son. Moses named him Gershom, for he explained, "I have been a foreigner in a foreign land." So Gershom's from a root meaning foreigner. Years passed. Yeah. 40 more years. He's 80 years old at this point. He's older than I am. That's a curious question that immediately comes up here. What's with the delay? Why is this taking so long? You know, 80 years? Couldn't we have got things ready in 40 years? Well, for one thing, he was waiting for the evil Pharaoh to die, the one that wanted Moses dead, and his other guys with him. So there's a whole new generation coming in. That's one thing. That comes up later in the text. But then, too, you find that God sometimes works this way. He's an eternal God. To him, he's not really in a hurry. He operates at a different pace than we do. We want things done. You know, we're on a schedule. We need things done yesterday. God's not that way. And he will take his time. And he's preparing his man. He may be preparing other factors that we don't know about in Egypt that may make it so it's not appropriate yet. Boom. He may do that with us. We may let us go for quite a while without a lot of success, without seeing God's hand moving in my life in a big way, but he's preparing us. We have to be up for that. He says, yeah, the kings of Egypt died, but the Israelites continued to groan under their burden of slavery. They cried out for help, and their cry rose up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant of promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He looked down on the people of Israel and knew now was time to act. Now, we don't know all the factors. We just don't. He knows. Exodus 3. One day, Moses was tending the flock of his father-in-law, Jethro. Jethro and Reuel are the same guy. Two different names. The priest of Midian. He led the flock far into the wilderness and came to Sinai, the mountain of God. There, the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire from the middle of a bush. Moses stared with astonishment though the bush was engulfed in flames, it didn't burn up. It's just sitting there flaming. The angel of the Lord, it's God. That expression, this is one of the titles that he goes under. It's not the Father, who no man has seen or can see. It's not the Holy Spirit, who's invisible. It's the pre-incarnate Christ. It's Jesus, before his incarnation. The angel of the Lord. Yeah. Gleason Archer points out that many Old Testament passages state that this angel of the Lord is God, and one of them is right here before us when we get down to verse 6. I am God. I'm Yahweh. It's the angel of the Lord. This is how, when he wants to communicate to people, he does it through his son, the Word. This is amazing, Moses said to himself. Why isn't that bush burning up? I must go see it. So he comes climbing up closer to it on a mountainside. When the Lord saw Moses coming to take a closer look, God called to him from the middle of the bush, Moses, Moses. Here I am, he replied. Don't come any closer, the Lord warned. Take off your sandals, for you're standing on holy ground. So here it turns, this is Yahweh. When we say the Lord saw Moses, Yahweh saw Moses. It's him. He sought Moses out. He showed up right where Moses will see him and has summoned him up. And yet, he can't come too close. He needs to stay back a little bit. He needs to take his shoes off. What we're seeing here is that Yahweh is not someone of the sort you can just blunder into his presence, slap him on the back. That's happening. What's up? God is distinct. He's transcendent. Yeah, they call it the holiness of God, the holiness. Holiness is kind of a church word. It means to be different. He's not like others. He's in his own class. Distinct or different. So it's the differentness of God. And that's a big thing that comes up in this book, is that you have, particularly when it comes to morality and evil versus good, God says, I'm in a different class than you, okay? I'm completely absolute good. You're not that. And so we're going to have problems getting together. And breaching this separation between a different God and a common profane humans is going to take us right down the ages of the plan of God to Jesus himself. Why did Jesus come? Why did he have to die? To heal the breach between God and us. To forgive and cleanse us from all of our sin so that we can come in and have intimacy with God after all. That hadn't happened yet here. I am God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. They must have had tales that they kept alive about these guys. When Moses heard this, he covered his face because he was afraid to look at God. Well, then the Lord told him, I've certainly seen the oppression of my people in Egypt. I've heard their cries of distress because of their harsh slave drivers. Yes, I am aware of their suffering. So I've come down to rescue them from the power of the Egyptians and lead them out of Egypt into their own fertile and spacious land. It's the land flowing with milk and honey. The land where the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites now live. Look, the cry of the people of Israel has reached me, and I've seen how harshly the Egyptians abused them. Now go, because I'm going to send you to Pharaoh. You must lead my people out of Egypt. And, you know, Moses is there kind of like, yeah, yeah. What? Me? I'm going to go back to, they want me dead down there. And he's like, wait a minute, just hold it right there. He says, who am I to appear before Pharaoh? Who am I to lead the people of Israel out of Egypt? God says, I'll be with you. And really, that's all he needs to know. If you understand God, God's saying, I'll be with you. Well, things are going to work out then. And he goes on, and this is your sign, and I am the one who has sent you. When you've brought the people out of Egypt, you're going to worship them right on this mountain. You're coming back to this mountain. Well, if I go to the people of Israel and I tell them the God of your ancestors has sent me to you, they're going to say, well, what's his name? And then what am I going to tell them? You know, Moses doesn't know God's name. And it leads to a very intriguing, interesting statement from God. He said to Moses, I am who I am. Say this to the people of Israel. I am has sent me to you. So this word here in Hebrew is Yahweh. They spell with all consonants, YHWH, and you have to insert your own vowels. So this is a transliteration. Yahweh is a transliteration. You'll also see in older Bibles and even some new ones, Jehovah, because they took the YHWH and they inserted the vowel pointings from Adonai, and it comes out Yahweh. So it's God's personal name. It has something to do with this statement, I am who I am. I am who I am. What is he saying here? What is he saying? I'll give you my guess. Maybe it's about the immutability of God. That means that God is unchanging. His character isn't one thing yesterday and something else tomorrow. He's not up and down. His attributes remain absolutely stable, immutable, unchangeable. So I am who I am, the unchanging, immutable God. Or is it God's infinitude, the infinity of God, the fact that God has always existed and always will exist, that there is no I was and I will be with God, just an eternal I am. I am who I am. Could have something to do with that. Or is it God as the beginning point, the ground of being, the starting point? If we go out and look out and try to say, what is this world that we're living in? You got to start somewhere. And philosophically, you need a ground. You need a starting point. And God is saying, I am Yahweh. That's your starting point right there. We start with God, who himself, people say, well, saying that God's eternal, where did he come from? There's no coming from when you're an eternal being. You just always are. As far back we go in history, God was there then, and he was just as old then as he is now. Yeah, that's how infinity works. So in our thinking, in our reasoning out, our starting point in everything is the great I am. That's where everything begins. Or is it the God who reveals himself, who is saying, I am who I am. I'm not who they say I am. I'm not what you say I am. I'm not what the other person says I should be. I am what I am, and people need to adjust to that. I've talked to people who are enraged by God, like the idea that God would judge people, that he would be a judge. That angers them. They say, I would never follow a God like that. And what does God reply to that defiant attitude? I am Yahweh. That's it. Yeah. So we have here probably a deep concept that deserves some thought. It's his personal name. Yahweh says, this is my name. He says it several times in this text. In our Bible, it's translated the Lord, like with a, the there, a particle. What's that doing there? There's no the in the name. The Lord sounds like it's a thing that we're describing. an office or something. It's really Yahweh. It should just be rendered like that. Or Jehovah, if you want. That tradition of changing it to Jehovah started because Jewish scribes were afraid of accidentally misusing the name of God, so they altered Yahweh to Jehovah. I am Yahweh. Tell them that Yahweh sent you. So God says to Moses, say this to the people of Israel. Yahweh, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham, God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. So here we discover, this is the second time that he's gone through the Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob sequence. And what's happening is that when he's saying, which God am I? I'm that God of them, the God that they knew and followed. That is to say that he's revealed in history. So much different than most gods in most religions, which are revealed primarily in nature or in subjective dreams, visions, and so forth. The God of the Bible, Yahweh, is mainly revealed through history. A great essay to read, which you can get for free in the ebooks. G. Ernest Wright, The Old Testament Against Its Environment, goes through this in detail. Super cool argument that he develops. And he's not a Bible believer. He's a liberal scholar, a Harvard professor of history. The issue, he says, is not the careful weighing of the various merits of the gods. In the Bible, the question is, who is God? Decide on the evidence and act accordingly. What is the evidence? It's the evidence of history. And so later in the Old Testament, you'll see God saying, I am the God who brought you up out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Right? I'm the God who did this. I'm the God who did that. And ultimately, the ultimate historical event, the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus. Actual events that literally happened, and that's why we believe him. Okay, well, he says, this is my eternal name, my name to remember for all generations. Now, go and call together the elders of Israel. Tell them Yahweh, the God of our ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to me. He told me, I've been closely watching, and I see how the Egyptians are treating you. I've promised to restore you from your oppression in Egypt, and I'll lead you to a land flowing with milk and honey, the land where all those guys live. The elders of Israel will accept your message, and then you and the elders must go to the king of Egypt and tell him, Yahweh is the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. So please let us take a 3-day journey into the wilderness to offer sacrifices to the Lord our God. Oh, that is really odd. What's with the 3-day journey thing? He's planning much more than that, right? Don't really know the answer to this. It may be that he's demonstrating that even the most reasonable request of a mere 3 days is going to be discarded anyway. And so he loses this 3-day thing as the narrative goes on, drops it, and just says, we need to go. But, yeah, something like that. He says, I know the king of Egypt will not let you go unless a mighty hand forces him. So I'll raise my hand and strike the Egyptians, performing all kinds of miracles among them. And then at last he'll let you go. And I'll cause the Egyptians to look favorably on you. They'll give you gifts when you go out, so you will not leave empty-handed. Yeah, they got all kinds of silver and gold. Every Israelite woman will ask for articles of silver and gold and fine clothing from the Egyptian neighbors and from the foreign women in their houses. You will dress your sons and daughters with these and will plunder the Egyptians. They're going to basically have their expenses paid for quite a ways into the future by all this money they're going to be given. Of course, in the view of God, the Egyptians owe that money to them. They've been making them work for free for hundreds of years. They owe that money, and they're going to pay it. Well, Exodus 4. Moses protested again. What if they won't believe me? What if they won't listen to me? What if they say the Lord never appeared to you? The Lord said, okay, what's that in your hand? A shepherd's staff. He said, throw it down on the ground. So he threw it down. It turns into a snake. He jumps back. And then Yahweh told him, reach out and grab its tail. He grabs the tail and it turned back into a shepherd's staff. Whoa. Supernatural miracle. And he says, perform this sign, the Lord told him. Then they'll believe that Yahweh, the God of their ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, really has appeared to you. Show this to the Israelites, to the Hebrews. Then Yahweh said to Moses, now put your hand inside of your cloak. And he put it in. When he pulled it out, it's covered in little severe skin disease. They call it leprosy, but they're not sure. Ancient people weren't sure what was leprosy and what was something else, but it's all covered with something bad, white as snow. Now put your hand back in your cloak, and he puts it in, and it comes back, and it's normal again. Another miracle. He always says to Moses, if they don't believe you and are not convinced by the first miracle sign, then give them the second one. And if they don't believe you, listen, even after these, take some water from the Nile River and pour it out on the dry ground. And when you do, the water from the Nile will turn into blood on the ground. But Moses says, Lord, I'm not very good with words. I never have been, and I'm not now, even though you've spoken to me. I get tongue-tied, and my words get tangled. I don't think I'm the right man for this job. Yahweh says, who makes a person's mouth? Yeah, who created the tongue? Is how NASB renders it. Who decides whether people speak or not speak, hear or not speak? Is it not I, Yahweh? I'm the one that created your tongue. I think I can figure out how to use it. Yeah. So really what's happening here, it seems like Moses is doubting himself. He doesn't feel very confident. But what he's really doing is he's doubting God. He's implying, you know, it's up to my speech and my eloquence to make this thing fly, and not recognizing that what really matters is God saying, I'll be with you. That's what matters here. And this still happens today, where we feel inadequate. We start to freeze up. We feel like I can't go forth for God. I can't speak for him. I'm too dumb. I'm not sharp enough. I'm not gifted enough. And yeah, just like the boy with the 5 loaves and 2 fish. You're like, oh, if you only had 10 loaves, you know, that wouldn't have made any difference. 10 loaves instead of 5. The point is that he put it in Jesus' hands. And so this is what we're referring to here is called not having the ability, but having the availability and making myself available to God, which Moses is not really doing here. Now go! I'll be with you as you speak, and I'll instruct you what to say. Just quit worrying about it. But Moses again pleaded to the Lord. Lord, please send someone, anyone else. I don't want to do this. And then we read, the anger of Yahweh burned against Moses, and lightning flashed out from the bush and struck Moses in the chest. No, that's actually not there. I made that up. But this is very interesting. It would fit, wouldn't it? If his anger is burning at Moses, isn't he going to zap him or something? No. All right, he said. What about your brother Aaron, the Levite? I know he speaks well. It's remarkable. It's like you can tell that he's annoyed significantly by Moses' foot dragging. And yet he very mildly, you know, says, okay, caves in to Moses and says, okay, we'll go with plan B. And look, he's on the way to meet you now. So, yeah, it turns out down in 427, the Lord said to Aaron, go to meet Moses in the wilderness. And so he went out and met him at the mountain of God and kissed him. He's walking up as this event happens. He looks over and here comes Aaron, his brother. So God knew this was going to happen. And he set this up in advance. Yet he still went through the whole thing. It was, I think, still important that he called Moses and gave Moses a chance to say yes, which he didn't, really. But check this out, too. He'll be delighted to see you. What? Where does that line fit into this narrative? I'm quite struck by it. It's empathy. God has sensed, he has put himself into Aaron's place. He's gonna love it when he sees you. He hasn't seen you in 40 years. And that mattered to God. God is a personal being. He's not a machine. He's not a computer. He's not a gas or an essence. He's a person. And here we see him. He's an emotional being. He can have anger. He's an empathetic being. He can feel what another is going to feel. A key part of humans created in the image of God is that we can empathize with other people. And we can sense how they would feel in this given situation. Put ourselves into their shoes, as it were. It's a concept that only applies to personal beings, of which God is one, and we are personal also. He's going to be delighted to see you. It seems like God is looking forward to that. I'm going to be there and watch that. Talk to him. Put the words in his mouth. I'll be with both of you to speak, and I'll instruct you both in what you should do. And so Aaron will be your spokesman to the people. He'll be your mouthpiece, and you can stand in the place of God for him, telling him what to say. So I'm God, I'll pass it to you. You'll be like God to him. You'll pass it to him. And take your shepherd's staff with you and use it to perform the miraculous signs that I've shown. Your shepherd's staff, yeah. Moses went back home to Jethro, his father-in-law. Please let me return to my relatives in Egypt, Moses said. I don't even know if they're still alive. And Jethro says, go in peace. So as part of a household, you would seek the patriarch's permission to leave. And he did that. Before Moses left Midian, the Lord said to him, return to Egypt, for all those who wanted to kill you have died. They're all gone. So Moses took his wife and sons and put them on donkey, headed back to the land of Egypt, and in his hand, he carried the staff of God. The staff has become the staff of God now. The topic of a very fantastic essay by Francis Schaeffer in his book, No Little People. Probably can buy it out here. Schaeffer says, one thing that's encouraged me as I've wrestled with my own sense of inadequacy is the way God used Moses' rod, a stick of wood. Nothing very big, no big deal. A dead stick of wood. And Exodus 4:20 tells us the secret of all that followed. The rod of God, Moses had become the rod of God. And that's our verse right there. What good is it to lift up a rod when one is caught between a cul-de-sac, between mountains on both sides, a great body of water, in the mightiest army on earth pursuing you from behind? Much good if the rod is the rod of God. God says, hold that rod out, and that's what will cause the dividing of the waters. It's the same rod Moses used to strike the stone and water gushed out to slake everyone's thirst. It's the same rod that grows buds and flowers, and later another story. It ends up in the tabernacle, in the Holy of Holies, to make people remember this whole episode. So the rod really didn't have to do much. It really didn't have to change itself or anything like that. it had to be the rod of God, and God could take a lowly stick and do all of these great works with it. And that should be, as Schaefer goes on to explain, he says the scripture emphasizes that much can come from little if the little is truly given over to God. There are no little people, there are, and no big people in the true spiritual sense, but only those given over and those not. If we're given over to God, he can take us just like that stick and use us for great things. To reach people with his spirit, to change lives, all kinds of things. And so, we're set for entry into Egypt. Slug it out with the Pharaoh. So what have we seen? Who is Yahweh after all? We saw that he's distinct, he's different than us. And this could be a problem. If something doesn't resolve that differentness there, we're going to have to stay at a distance from him. And it's a good thing that Jesus came and paid that price to bring our distance from God away, to make it so that we become the righteousness of God in him who knew no sin. 2 Corinthians 5, yeah. And so he solved that problem for us. He is the eternal and the unchanging I am, the beginning point of all knowledge, all thought. No wonder the Proverbs say the beginning of knowledge is the reverence of the Lord. That's if you want to have no knowledge, if you want to know wisdom, that's your starting point. Understand who God is. He is who he is. He's not who we want him to be. We don't get to vote on what God is like. We don't get to declare the boundaries of what he's allowed to be. I am that I am. And that's it. He's personal. He likes us. In fact, he loves us. In the Gospel of John, we read Jesus saying that God so loved the world. He loved the world, not just the believers, but the whole world, that he sent his only begotten Son so that whoever believes in him would not perish but have everlasting life. God paid a huge price to make it possible for us to get back together with him. Huge price. We'll never know how high the price is that Jesus paid. He can feel us. He can feel, we read that in the New. It's well taught, actually, in the Bible that we have a merciful and faithful high priest who can sympathize with our weaknesses. Sympathy, empathy. There's a technical difference, but they're very related. God knows how I feel. He can feel how I feel. That's really important to know that, because people often tend to treat God as in an impersonal way, like a slot machine. You say this, you do that, and then your cigarettes come down. Or whatever. We learn already that God was back then pursuing a plan of rescue, and that plan extends right up past the New Testament and right up to our own day. He's still pursuing that same plan of rescue. And a really cool element comes in here, which is we get to join in. If we want. It's up to us. Don't have to. But it's the coolest thing that you could ever be a part of. It's the most important thing that's going on in the world today is God's plan of rescue for the human race. And he's spreading that out to more and more people, viciously opposed by his enemy. Yes. Oh, it's a struggle, but it's awesome. And we saw that he can make the large out of the little. That means that even I can be used. Even I can be transformed. And God can take me like that stick and use me. Yes, God, I'd like to see that happen. Use me a lot. I want to be a part of what you're doing here. We should all pray that. Yeah, we thank you, God, that you are a rescuing God, that you're into rescuing all of us, including from our own folly and sin. We're blown away by the awful price you had to pay for that. You must really want to rescue us a lot to pay that price at the cross. And we pray for anyone here tonight, God, who's just exploring you, hasn't necessarily brought you into their life, that they would just open their heart to you and just say, yeah, God, I want to know you and I want to have you in my life. I come as I am, you know. I don't deserve it, but I'll take the gift that you're giving out. Thank you for everyone that may have prayed that tonight here, God. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.